as we're looking at needs, and if we're thinking of preaching to people's needs, we could, without warning perhaps, tend to almost make a very earthy message. And there are sometimes we need to preach on something like, say, worship, around Easter, the resurrection of Christ. We need to preach on the Trinity. How do you kind of link this in to preaching with needs? I know you do. I know you personally do, but how do you do this? I think this is a very relevant question, and right at the heart of introduction, right at the heart of what you're saying.
I don't know. When we talk about need in the introduction, though the illustrations that I tended to give you explored personal need, it is simply to say, if you are going to preach a sermon on worship, then why are you preaching it? Why do the people need to know it? And what is there in their experience that would be stronger and better if they knew about this? If you say to me, I haven't got the slightest notion of why people would respond to this, I think God wants them to know it, but I don't know why they would respond, I'd just say there's no way they're going to get it. And if I said, is there any application to what you're saying? And you say, oh yeah, there's application, and you would tell me what the application is. And all I'm saying is that what you would put at the end as application needs to move into the beginning as need, because what application is to say this truth touches where you live in life. If I were going to preach on Hebrews chapter 12, that great section and one of the great difficult passages where it says we have come to Mount Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God, to the gathering of angels in festive array, to the assembly of the firstborn whose names are written in heaven, to the judge who is God of all, to the spirits of just men and women made perfect, and to Jesus, who is the mediator of a new covenant, whose blood speaks better things of Abel. That passage, as I understand the writer to the Hebrews, this is pay dirt for him. That is one of the things you have to decide in the book of Hebrews, is what kind of a book you're dealing with. Is it a book of doctrine that has in it periods of exhortation? You know, you have the warnings in chapter 2, chapter 4, chapter 6, chapter 10, chapter 12. Is it a book of doctrine that throws in the warnings? Or is it a book of warnings based on doctrine? And the writer of Hebrews says at the end, suffer this word of exhortation. It's obvious he's a preacher. Have gone for 12 chapters. He calls it a word. But he sees it as exhortation. Is a way of preaching Hebrews in which you preach it as Bible doctrine and not pay attention to the warnings. Or you sort of touch them. In fact, in some commentaries, they are put in parenthesis. They are sort of, insertions. But the real argument is going along and he sort of throws this in. I'd argue that the book of Hebrews is written for those warnings and that the theology is included for the warnings. Now that's a whole, there's two different views of that book. If you see it as a book of warnings, then the writer sat down because he saw needs that these people had, the danger of drifting back into Judaism, going back to a form of worship that was part of their past. And so he comes to the end to this section I was telling you about. And I think he is dealing with the question, what happens when we worship? He has said, we don't come, the previous paragraph says, we don't come to Mount Sinai with all of its appeal to the senses. We have come to Mount Zion, City of Living God. Well, if I were going to, I think the subject of that paragraph is what happens when we worship. And as I've been working my way through it, I think the first thing he is saying is that when we worship, we are confronted with spiritual realities. Mount Zion, Holy City, so forth. He is saying that we come in contact with a universal fellowship with angels and all of those whose names are written in heaven. We come face to face with the judge and discover we're forgiven. We come to Jesus Christ. If I were to start that, I would start by pointing out the fact that for many people, some form, that worship's a wide yawn. There's a story making the rounds that I hope with all my heart is apocryphal of a mother that comes into her son's bedroom and she says, "Son, Sunday morning, time to get up, time to go to church." He says, "I don't want to go to church." She says, "Son, you got to go to church." He says, "I don't want to go to church. I don't like church. People there don't like me and I don't like them. I don't like the music. It's not my style. Preaching bores me." Moses, "Son, you got to go to church. You're 32 years of age and you're the pastor. You're expected to be there." But the reason that story has zing to it is that a lot of people feel that about church. We go, but, it's a poor substitute for a picnic on a Sunday. This writer is saying there are things that happen when we come together to worship that happen in no other way. That it will never be accomplished by taking a picnic to the park. And he wants to tell them, well, I would somehow dabble around with that. If I don't get you to be at all interested in why in the world what happens when we worship, then why tell you? You mentioned the Trinity. I was at church in Chicago just attending. And the pastor got up and said, "Today our topic's on the Trinity. Our topic is the Trinity. Theologians have divided the Trinity into two major parts. The unity of the Trinity, and the unity of the Trinity, the personality of the Trinity. I want to talk first about the unity of the Trinity." We talk about the unity of the Trinity. In three parts. We talk about the personality of the Trinity. It's not an abstraction. So I thought, only a preacher thinks this way. I mean, he has the idea that these people, when they got out of bed in the morning, said, "Oh, I noticed the pastor's going to speak on the Trinity. Let's get there early so we get a good seat." You think that? You fell off the turnip truck. I mean, I wouldn't want to be around people who thought that was a hot topic to hear on a Sunday morning. I mean, they're unplugged. Nobody thinks that. So here he was getting up, assuming an interest on the part of the audience without at all in any way trying to touch need. Why in the world would you ever preach on the Trinity? There's all kinds of answers to that. It is the foundational doctrine of the Christian faith. Thomas Smith, the theologian, said, "He who tries to understand it will lose his mind. He who fails to believe it will lose his soul." So you have to raise the question, how in the world did theologians ever come up with a doctrine like this? I mean, did they get together in a smoke-filled room in the back of a religious convention and say, "Look, let's come up with a doctrine which from here on out everybody will have to believe in, and I'll never forget this committee"? I mean, how in the world do you come to believe 3 equals 1, 1 equals 3? And put that at the center of your faith. Did they sit around and say, "Well, let's come up with something that, Isn't that really tough to believe? I don't think so. I think the way they came up with it came out of their experience. Early Christians were Jews. There was one thing they believed, is the Lord our God is one. And that separated them from every other religion in the ancient world. They believed that. That was at the core of their being. Wake them up at 2 in the morning and say, what is the heart and core of your faith? The Lord our God is one God. No, they were fishermen, but they were Jews. And then into their lives, they walked the man. They couldn't quite understand. They watched him, and he did what only God could do. They listened to him, and he spoke as only God could speak. And they came to the conclusion that he must be God. And these are Jews. And they had a problem. Because they would go out in the morning and discover that he had been out on the countryside and he had been praying to God. And they were so certain they would have died about it, that he was God. Now they had two. And this God who was in the midst of them, and the God to whom he prayed. And then, just before he left, he said to them, look, I'm leaving. Don't be overly concerned. We're going to send, my Father, we'll send the Spirit to you. He's going to be with you. Spirit wasn't Jesus. I'm the Father. Now they had three. But they believed at the depths of their soul, Lord our God is one God. I don't think presenting it, I mean, this is how they came to it. I don't think presenting it that way is catering to people's whims. It is really coming to grips with how do you get people to care? How do they get them to understand? How do you get them to say, I need to understand this. I need to be able to appropriate it. And then, obviously, it has everything to do with the way you present the gospel. Now, we have the idea, we preach, you know, that we sinned and God was angry at our sin. Jesus came to earth. Jesus loves us. And as a result, because he loved us, he went to the cross. And by his death on the cross, satisfied the angry God of heaven. Away from that, God's an ogre, Jesus is a good friend. That is heresy. That is to misunderstand the Bible. Because you're not dealing in the death of Christ with a hard God softened, but a loving God giving. So you're not dealing with two gods. Tough, hard God. You know, saying, all I'm saying is that has all kinds of application. You're dealing, but you've got to ask, how does it touch life? What difference does that make? So when you talk about needs, you're not always talking about personal needs. But I would simply say that there aren't many topics that really matter very much that don't matter to us. If I worship and God is a spectator and I am the one, it matters that I understand what I'm doing when I come, or else I'm going to make a mess of it. I'm going to spend a lot of time doing the wrong thing. So I need to know the right things. I want people to, I want to touch them wherever I can, get as close to them as possible. So that in talking about speaking to needs, it is simply reflecting that a sermon is designed to change life. If it is designed to change life, then up front, I want to be giving folks some idea of what part of their lives this might touch. And if you tell me, well, no, this sermon is a sermon, it's devoted to theology, but it doesn't change any life, all I'm saying is forget it. I don't know why you're preaching it. Because I read the Bible, that's what the Bible is designed to do. You don't get these abstract theological things. You only get those in seminaries, university. You got folks writing the Bible who are, you get Paul, you know, moving around the Roman Empire, writing on the fly. You got people reading this who are coming apart at the seams. So what am I dealing with? Why? Yes. It's all right. I know you're choked, but
I had a show. Haddon, I'm not quite sure how to ask this. You made a comment, which I kind of agree with, but I want to query, which is the one about, I certainly agree with the first half, where you say that we're not talking to people about the Bible. I hate sermons that are about the Bible as such. But we're talking to about people from the Bible. I think that's how you said it, something like that.
Yeah.
Recently, a friend of ours, a thoroughly secular girl, has become a Christian, moved to a large country centre, and we can't convince her to go to a church there. She says she's been all around them. She said, I'd just like to find a church that talks about God. And her frustration is that the sermons, in an attempt to be relevant, are always about us. And in that, I was surprised that no one asked you about that definition, because I would have, because there's a sense in which, you know, we're talking about God. And, you know, the gospel is a message about God, it's also a message about man. And I guess that balance about felt need, that thing from Cohen, that law, when you're in Jesus in Mark, where he regularly walks away from people's felt need, you know, he walks away from crowds who are sick to go on to preach, and the guy gets let down through the roof with clear felt needs, and he seems to almost heal him as proof that he's able to deal with the more serious needs. I was walking all around the question, but it's something to do with preaching God and the difficulty of dealing with felt needs, when I think sometimes Jesus in the gospel, you know, says...
Okay, sorry, I think if you simply are dealing with felt needs, that's all we're talking about, then the tendency, that kind of a sermon often never gets to the Bible. It never really ties into God at all. So my felt need is a lack of self-esteem, and I tell you, if you're a Christian, you'll think better about yourself. Or I come into that rat about you can't love God unless you love yourself, because you know the God says you to love you and love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and your neighbor is yourself. So if you look at that, first of all, you got to love yourself in order to love your neighbor, in order to love God. I mean, that's an absolute rape of that text. Jesus, there's no place in the Bible that says, you know, pick up your own self-esteem and then you can love your neighbor and love yourself. If you really want to love yourself, start loving God, start loving your neighbor, and that love outside will do something to you. I mean, but that's the kind of thing, a felt need. You got to have self-esteem. And how do you get self-esteem? Well, psychologists have found that just, you know, you spend a period every day thinking how wonderful you are. That's the kind of thing that stays at the surface. It's not distinctly Christian. What I would argue is that the felt need with which you start must be tied to a deeper need. That is, ultimately, when you are dealing with biblical thought, there may be needs out here that a person feels that are symptomatic of a deeper need that only God can meet, that can only be met by an understanding of God. So that the sermon begins where people are, but it doesn't leave them where they are. If it's distinctly Christian and it moves into the biblical text, behind the biblical text, there is always God. There is always God's revelation. There's always God's dealing with this at a deeper level. It is true that if you really come to know God and understand what he has done for you, that you will have better self-esteem. But you don't get it as a direct result. In fact, you begin when you stand in the presence of God, recognizing your wretchedness, and you come to know the forgiveness of God, the constant hunger and thirst for righteousness. But it isn't self-esteem, and it's answered this way. You have to move into theology, into the scriptures. All I'm arguing as a principle of communication, you've got to start where people are, and in that sense, you're talking to them about them from the Bible. But when you say you're talking to them about them from the Bible, it's akin to saying you're talking to the patient in your office, if you're a physician, about him and his disease from the medical books. But if this person comes and has got a growth, and you say, you know, oh boy, it's bad, and that's melanoma, but I'll put a bandage on it, put some salve, I'll feel better. I say, no, you can talk to him from the medical books, because he's got cancer. The only way to get rid of that or the way is you've got to have chemotherapy. But I start where the patient is. I don't. When a patient comes in to the office, I don't say to the patient, you know, I've been doing some reading about kidney disease. Kidney disease. So I was talking about kidney disease. I don't have kidney disease. That's all right, but you ought to know about it. All I'm saying is it doesn't connect, doesn't work. But if a person has melanoma and he says, well, you know, I got this growth back here, it's just a growth. The good physician goes to the medical books. Before he's through, he has diagnosed the disease of the bloodstream. But that disease of the bloodstream keeps showing up in symptoms. And part of what we do is to deal at first with symptoms. This is what people feel. They're scratching. I start there. But if I go into the biblical text always takes me and relates me to God. I mean, that's the nature of the scriptures. And so the question is an excellent one. But I'm what we're wrestling with is a means of communication and how people learn. And how we get this message into people's lives. Should people know about the Trinity? Absolutely. I mean, you can't be a Christian in your thought if you don't deal with the Trinity. But the question is, where do you meet this? Why does it come up? Why do you have to know about it? If you don't answer that, then I don't think you're going to be able to teach the doctrine of the Trinity. But if you say, oh yeah, you have to know the doctrine of the Trinity, and I say, why? The answer to that is where you start in your sermon. You don't wait till the end to tell me. Up front, you give me a reason why this is going to work. Does that make sense? Does it come through?
So, briefly on that, I think my concern is that certainly in our country, or in my part of the world anyhow, there's a constant fight about what the gospel is and isn't. And, you know, there are all these statements from the apostles that you know, him we proclaim, we preach Christ crucified, not us, you know, we preach Christ, not ourselves, etc. And I think my vague unease, and I'm really not, it sounds strong, as I'm not
no, I hear you.
Orthodox
sure.
or anything like that. But it's just when we have a definition that we're talking about people, and yet when the apostles talk about what they talk about, they define it, we're talking about Jesus. And I just think a lot of us keep getting it wrong, because I think this friend of mine's not uncharitable analysis of the churches, all the churches in her area, was that they keep talking about not us in relationship to God, but us, or God in relation to us, but essentially the focus is on me. And I think that's why I'm a little uneasy with that as a definition of what we're doing. I agree, I don't like talks about God in the abstract, they are awful. But if we're not clear that our topic is Jesus.
Okay, let me try it again. If you take every sermon in the book of Acts, now they are obviously evangelistic. I mean, not in truth. Paul's message to the Ephesian elders is not, but generally. Now you don't have any example in Acts of what they did in their regular worship services, okay? But you cannot take the sermon in Acts 2 and put it in Acts 4. You can't take the sermon in Acts 4 and put it in Acts 17. You can't take the sermon in Acts 17 and make it Paul's sermon to the Ephesian elders. They are so related to their audience that you can't change them around. Okay? So that when Peter preaches at the day of Pentecost, it's obvious that he's preaching about Jesus. But he starts talking to this audience about their experience of the phenomena of tongues and the outpouring of the Spirit. And as he's developing the sermon, he goes back to that phenomena to show that Jesus has ascended. When Paul comes to Mars Hill, he starts with what he has seen these people doing. They are in a search for a God that they don't know. And he sees this in the architecture, and he sees it in the idols. Okay, he begins with this. And he talks to them about that because that's where they are. He illustrates it from their poets, because their poets had an insight to this. Okay, in that sense, he's talking to them about them. He's talking to the Athenians about where the Athenians are. That sermon would not have worked in Jerusalem.
I may just be being heavy on that phrase because we're talking about them. The subject in the sermon of Athens is clearly God. As he relates to them, and the way he talks about it is very specific.
What I think our hang up is here is, if you ask me what are we preaching about when you talk about the content of our sermon, obviously we're preaching about God, preaching about Christ. I'm dealing with homiletics, and when I talk about homiletics, I am talking about how you present, how you communicate. In doing that, I'm not making a theological statement. I'm making a communicative statement. And I'm saying, as a communicator, I'm talking to this person out there about him from the Bible. In saying that, I'm not talking theology, I'm not talking even about the content of the sermon, I'm talking about the way the sermon is presented. Okay, and that's, I think the thing we're wrestling with is that it's a proper response, you're taking it as a theological statement, and, I don't mean it theologically. I'm talking about it as a perception of a communicator that I cannot ignore this audience. I cannot start away from where the audience is at. In that sense, I talk to them about them. I probably overstated it if I had said the subject and the object is the audience, because that was an overstatement. That was a hyperbole. Because obviously, if I don't bring these people to know God as God is, what I cannot do is tailor-make God for this audience. That is, I am preaching the Bible, and I'm talking to them from the Scriptures. I can't tailor-make the Bible for this audience. And I hope I've gotten that across, that if I go to the text, I've got to find out what this text says and what, you know, how it is saying it. I am concerned that in our circles, even the more orthodox circles, they come to the Scriptures, and as I look at the passage, that's not what that passage is teaching. You know, in that sense, they're talking to the audience about something, but they're not talking to them about the Bible. Yeah.
I think the difficulty that I face as an evangelical Christian is that I look at a Harry Emerson Fosdick, who used some of the communication
right.
principles you're using, or Kemp's life situation preaching, but he wasn't rooted in the Scripture.
Right.
And see, the problem is, I see it throwing out these communication principles to the detriment of communicating the biblical reality. And I'm hearing you say we've got to communicate at a level that people understand and identify with, but we never lose our root in the Scriptures.
Harry Emerson Fosdick had a great lead. If you read his sermons, his introductions, the first part of his sermon, superb stuff, some great material. But Harry Emerson Fosdick had very little to offer in the area of his prescription. In fact, he's often good in the area of etiology. He can sort of tell you how you got in the mess we're in. But when he tells you how to get out of the mess, that's when he gives the game away, because he is no longer speaking from the Scriptures. But the principle that he enunciated in his article in Harper's Magazine, that preaching in terms of its form starts with the people and the needs that they have. He is the first person, interestingly enough, in the history of preaching who enunciated that. That is, the Greco-Roman model did not start with people's needs. It didn't start It started with an intellectual question. He was the first person to do that. You're absolutely right. If you throw out Hamry, the insight that flaws the cat about where sermons begin, you miss what he had to contribute. If you go to Fosdick to find out where sermons should end, then you're led astray, because his liberalism took him away from the Bible. The difference of an evangelical as to a Harry Emerson Fosdick is not that you preach to people's needs. The difference is you preach the scriptures and say, this book meets those needs. And that's not what Fosdick and people of his ilk believe. My quarrel with Fosdick had to do with where he took people after his introductions and after his opening. Yes?
One of the examples you have in the 12 sermons is a sermon on Exodus 20, verse 3, I think it is, about you shall not commit adultery. And I think it's an example of a case where the method looks, it's a very well-worked sermon, very well constructed, and I'll bet it was preached brilliantly. But it's not a sermon that's based on the authority of the Bible. Because in fact, what he has to do, he has to look around for possible reasons in our psychology, our sociology, for why adultery can be wrong. And he goes through a lot of those in the sermon very cleverly. But of course, he doesn't really speak from God when he says it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's
the
weakest sermon. I think it's the weakest sermon in the book. And it, as you know, the comments that I made on it, I said I did not think it was, except in a very wide sense, expository message. Had he developed that he shall not commit adultery and drawn his first ring around the people of Israel as to why God said that to them, and then his second ring as to what the New Testament is saying about adultery in 1 Corinthians 6 and in the Thessalonian letter, you know, then it would have been a topical exposition. I wouldn't completely discount what Lutzer did, in that there is a place in preaching to bring as part of a sermon the psychological insight as to what adultery does in a relationship. But if that's all you do, then the basis of authority is on, you know, the psychological or the sociological. But I think of all the sermons, I think in terms of its biblical orientation, it was the weakest of the bunch, and I would agree. Okay, I don't know where we're at. But these are good questions, because you've got to wrestle with your authority and you've got to wrestle with what you are as a preacher. Yes?
Dr. Robinson, I certainly sympathize with what you've been saying, but no problems with that. Can you perhaps just enlarge on this point? You've mentioned that in homiletics your concern is with getting the message into the hearts and the minds of the people. Can you just comment on the application of these communication principles you're talking about to Paul's comments, for example, in 1 Corinthians 2? I know you've had this doubtless brought up to you many, many times, but I can appreciate exactly what you're getting at. Tremendously powerful, tremendously effective. Is there not the danger, I guess that's the way I'm putting it, is there not the danger of us relying on our communication techniques, on psychological principles, to in fact substitute the work of the Holy Spirit? As Paul says in that passage, he would specifically have their faith rest in the power of God and not in the wisdom of men. Now, how do you tie these two things? How do you distinguish where psychological human communication principle is to end, if you can draw the line? I'm sure you get the kind of...
Sure. It's a tough line to draw.
Right.
And as you well know, throughout church history, people have wrestled with it. As I understand the Corinthian letter, and there's been a dissertation written at Oxford by Duane Lifton on those three chapters, Paul is writing in Greek life in the second sophistic. And during that time, oratory was an end in itself. Originally, in Greek life, the first books on rhetoric came to enable people to argue their case before the citizens of Athens when, for example, they'd been off the war and some of their land was confiscated. And they had to stand before the citizenry and argue their case. Okay. But by the time of the second sophistic that came along, because of the domination of the Roman government, no longer did speak, was speaking what free people did in order to plead their case before a jury. So you had oratory that came along that would be very much like a declamation contest, in which people spoke, and orators spoke, as a means of showing their brilliance. And one of the marks of the really good orator was that he could almost persuade people against their will. And one of the marks of the second sophistic was the idea that if you really heard a marvelous persuader, you would not know he persuaded you, because he would do it with such skill that it would not call attention to the technique, but that you would change. Okay. We also know, and this is what I think a major contribution of Lipton's dissertation is, that Corinth was one of the leading centers for rhetorical expression. Rhetoricians, speakers, whatever you want to call them, would come to Corinth and they would speak to the assembled crowds, and they were given prizes. They were given laurel wreath, they were given other kinds of prizes for being excellent orators. In that chapter, Paul, in those chapters, Paul isn't arguing that what those people did was heresy, or that when Christians use it, it was heresy. What he is saying, though, is when I came to you, I did not come relying on those techniques to persuade you about the gospel. I came to you, he said, in weakness, so that the ultimate strength of your belief would not be on the technique, it would be on the message itself. And that's, as I understand his argument, that's what he is saying. So that after he isn't saying people did not become Christians as a result of that. He is saying there's a way in which if you become a Christian as a result of that kind of a technique, then you look back and you wonder, is your faith in the having been moved by the orator, or because it is really in the Word of God? If I were translating that into 20th century, to give you an example, back in the 70s, Hal Lindsey wrote The Late Great Planet Earth. When I was at the Christian Medical Society, a number of the physicians, when they were in med school, read that book, and as a result of reading the book, had put their faith in Christ. I met them in the late 70s, and they were Christians. No doubt they were Christians. But the world had changed. Lindsey kept reading the headlines of the morning paper into his into the Bible. And it looked for all the world, like in the late 60s, that this is the end of the world. And they had put their faith in Christ as a result of reading the book. Now, 10 years later, Russia wasn't quite what Russia was supposed to be. The common market wasn't what the common market was, you know, all that kind of thing. And they raised questions about how they came to put their trust in Christ. Okay. There's no doubt they were Christians, but they, that book didn't stand up 10 years later. I think there's the element of that is what Paul is dealing with. It is also true that in 1 Corinthians, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9, I'll be all things to all men and women, that by all means I might win some. That verse in 1 Corinthians 9 is, I think, a statement of his strategy. That in order to win people to Christ, he would be to the Jew a Jew, he would be to the Greek a Greek, he would be to the weak, those who had tender consciences of the weak. He doesn't say he would be to the strong as the strong. But he will be all things to all men and women, that by all means he might win some. In other words, he is saying, I will adapt to the audience. I will bring my message of the gospel to bear on where they are psychologically, because if you analyze in that passage what he means by strong, what he means by weak, what he means by Greek, what he means by Jew, part of it is cultural, part of it is psychological. And Paul is saying, I'll do anything short of sinning to win men and women to Jesus Christ, and I will adapt what I have to say to them. So you have what he has over in 1 Corinthians, first three chapters, and you have this in chapter 9, and the question is, how do you bring it together? In terms of persuasion, I think the place that you draw the line is using persuasive techniques to bring people to make a decision to trust Jesus Christ. But I don't think Paul is talking about how you orient to them, how you relate the message to them. I think he is saying what the orators did was to get decisions, to get people to make acts of the will, to use a certain kind of psychology, to make a response. And Paul said, I didn't do that. There's no doubt, if you take what he's saying later in the book, that he did relate his message to them and to where they were at. But he is, when it came to the place of persuasion, to the place of change, place of decision, it was not because he was psychologically manipulating. A manipulator is somebody who gets you to change apart from the truth. An advertiser is a manipulator. If the advertiser says to you, if you want to be popular with young women, what you have to do, you ought to use Brill Cream. And you get the image of the girls around this guy who has, you know, grease on his hair. But the product does not produce that result. The manipulation is the advertiser appeals to your desires, to your felt needs, if I can put it that way. But what he offers you here promises to meet these needs, but it doesn't. So manipulation as opposed to persuasion, I use persuasion in this sense, positively, manipulation negatively. Paul would say, I gave you the gospel. I gave you this message to solve this problem, and if you take this message, it will solve this problem. I didn't simply look at your problems and then promise that the gospel would be able to do that. If, for example, you're preaching, and you're preaching to people, and you say, if you trust Jesus Christ will solve the problem of your broken home. That's manipulation. If you say to people, you're depressed, you're feeling bad about yourself, you come to Jesus Christ, he'll solve your depression. That's manipulation. The gospel doesn't promise to do that. If you are having an evangelistic meeting and you give an invitation, and you know that if you play the music faster, people are more likely to respond, and you play the music faster and people respond, that's manipulation. Because they're coming down that aisle, they don't know what they're coming for. Smell a little flowers, see the new rug, I mean, there's all sorts of things you get. If in a message, I am preaching a message, and I say to you, those of you, I'd like all of you to stand. Okay. Now, those of you who are Christians, you be seated. I want to talk to you standing. That's manipulation. If you say to a group of people, if you're concerned, if you've got a burden, I put up your hand and let me pray for you. So people put up their hand. And then I say, now if you put up your hand, that shows that you've got a spiritual concern. Now what I want you to do is to come down this aisle, shake my hand, meet one of our counselors. That's manipulation. What I am doing is getting a result that has nothing to do with the content. If you hear me saying that, that's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about biblical preaching. But it is true, I start where people have a felt need. Many of those felt needs, I must drive to a deeper need. Because this is merely a symptom of a deeper need that Christ can meet. I preached a message a couple of years ago on Psalm 48. Dealing with the question, what do you do with death? And as you know, that's a riddle. The psalm is a riddle. When I was all through, I had some folks come to me and say, you're concerned about relevant preaching. Why did you preach that? That is the most relevant question that men and women face today. Because you don't have an answer for the question, what do you do about death? You're not in the game. That is a biblical question. A person comes to the midlife crisis. At least in our country, for middle class men, it's an enormous crisis. Research is that 80-some percent of men go through it, and some of them never make it through. The Bible doesn't speak to midlife crises, although you have an example of David who blew the bit. But it doesn't speak to that directly. But the essence of the midlife crisis is you become aware of your own mortality. Suddenly are aware that you have a certain number of years left. You're going to die. The Bible speaks to that. So, and I think that Paul would say, making connections, being all things to all people, or all means you might win some, that's perfectly acceptable. Speaking to their condition, what they feel, that's acceptable. But when it comes to decision, I must be sure that what I tell them the gospel promises, the gospel is able to deliver. Otherwise, that's manipulation. And there's a great deal of manipulation in preaching today in which you simply say, here's a felt need, and if you trust Jesus Christ, if you really give yourself to Christ, he can meet that need. Well, maybe that's true. He can meet it. If you say he will meet that need, that's not true. Because you know all kinds of people who are Christians who are married, for example, whose marriages at best are a C+. And I'm convinced that if you can be the most dedicated Christian in the world and have a mediocre marriage. Some people got married wrong. I mean, you know, just the personality. Biblically, you stay together. I mean, that's good. Biblically, you don't break it up. But the idea that you often get in family conferences that if you trust Jesus Christ and if you really follow the biblical principles, you'll have an A marriage is absolute tommy rot. There are other factors involved in a marriage. You can have a marriage that's satisfying, but it doesn't mean that a person, I know of a couple where she's got a university degree of the highest order, he's not gotten through high school. In no way that couple is going to have a warm and vibrant A+ marriage. But they're Christians, and they take their commitment to each other seriously. But the Bible doesn't promise that if you follow biblical principles, you're going to have a warm and happy and growing and wonderful relationship. It just doesn't. And that's manipulation. And that's part of that's what we're dealing with. And I think that's wrong, because the Bible doesn't promise that. So if you're asking what I think Paul is talking about, he's talking about manipulation by which the orator would promise and get people to respond, but what he promised and what he had to deliver didn't work. So that would be how I'd answer the question.
I remember going to a seminar a few years ago where they mentioned that different groups of people learn in different ways. Some people learn by having the example first, then going to the abstract. And others go from abstract to example, so you'd basically do example, abstract, example, so you hit them both. That seems to be different to what you were saying this morning, where we learn in life through example, going from example to abstract. Can you comment on that and how
people
that works?
Who are part of academia tend to learn better when you give them the abstract and follow it with a principle. People who are who aren't in academia tend, and the big word is tend, to be the other way around. If you do them both, if you have the abstraction, the example, and the abstraction, then that's a good way to, you know, to package it. In the sense that there's a clarity about what this example is about. Because academia, all of your life, you're dealing with abstractions, you're dealing with didactic approach, and that's how it occurs. But again, it may also, I mean, that sounds too absolute. It's also, there's a personality. there are personality factors there as to how people learn, because we run tests with the students who come to Denver on learning styles, and the majority of students who come to Denver, their learning style is they like to sit in rows and take notes. But that's because the other people all got weeded out going through university. There are some who learn with hands-on. Certain kinds of students who want all of the assignments spelled out in detail. Tell me exactly what I've got to do, all this. Other students would rather say, rather have you say, this is what I want in terms of the final product. I don't care how you get it. And they learn. The older the student, the more likely who's been out and come back, the more likely he or she responds to that. So it isn't all education, although education tends to sit in rows, take notes, and then give it back to the professor. It's as though the test of education of sheep is that they vomit up what you've taught them, whereas the real test is whether they produce wool.
Is that relevant to does that have any impact on preaching style?
Yeah, I think one of the things you are trying to do is to bring a variety into your preaching. So you will use different, at different times, different ways of presenting. You don't do all narrative, don't do all story, don't do all your illustrations the same way. Certainly you don't do all inductive sermons. Different, just as we try knowing the, like in a class, if I look and see how students have different learning styles, and they are often maybe three different styles in a class, a major style, other styles, I will try to fashion my assignments so that at least one of the assignments appeals to people with one kind of style to help them learn. You do that as a preacher. I think that's there.
American authors Trent and Smalley writing a lot about word pictures and use, their use in communication. Would you care to comment on good things that we could do perhaps to increase our skills in using that technique?
Yeah, I think good preaching deals with word pictures. I think it's very concrete, very specific rather than abstract. They use it in terms of how people communicate with one another, and it may be an offshoot of that. I think people think with pictures in their heads. And so the more I can work with pictures, the more likely people are to respond intellectually and emotionally. And they're dealing with the emotional level of picture terms, that wives will think in one, women or wives will think in one kind of picture, men think in another, and they would argue that that's why they talk past each other. I think there may be some truth to that. I think one problem you have with men doing all the preaching is that women have to translate sermons into womanese. They have to listen to men preach, and they go very adept at making, you know, this is what this means to a woman. Men have certain, tend to have certain images that they use, that we use when we communicate, that may or may not connect with women. By the way, picking up the question here, this is very, you've raised it and raised here. The opposite heresy is to sin that grace may abound. And that's the heresy of saying if you're boring, then God can use a boring sermon and that demonstrates the power of God. And that is the heresy, that let's sin that grace may abound. Let's be boring so that God can get all the glory. There are dangers on both sides of the ditch, and more preachers fail in the second heresy than fail in the first. Very few preachers fail because they're too interesting. An awful lot fail because they're too boring. And the idea that God is going to bless boring sermons better than interesting sermons is an equal danger. In fact, I would say, just definitely, it's a sin to bore people with the Bible, because you're reflecting on who God is. So, dangers fall on every side, don't they? But the danger cannot warn you off in such a way that you don't do something. You need to know with it. On one hand, the danger is it's all need and no solution. Other danger, it's all solution, no need. Someplace I got to hit the middle. Okay, any other questions? Yes.
One observation that I've, after watching you for the last two or three days, is that you use a lot of hand motions. How important is it that you use hand motions? And if it is important, how do you implement it or learn it?
Well, I can answer your first question maybe easier than your second. There's quite a bit of research now that says that nonverbal communication is more important in the full-orbed communication than just the words themselves. I think putting it in the statistics that they have is something like 30% of our communication is words and the rest of it's nonverbal. How they figured that out, I'm not quite sure. It is true that people tend to believe your nonverbal behavior more than your verbal behavior. Probably because we think a person can control his or her words, but we really don't believe that the person can control the nonverbal behavior. An actor learns to control nonverbal behavior to a degree, but at least psychologically that's what occurs. If the nonverbal behavior contradicts the verbal behavior, then I think there's irrefutable evidence that you will listen to the nonverbal behavior. If I say to you, God loves you, God cares about you, I may be saying words of love, but the nonverbal is there. You could be a punch you in the mouth. Or I'll punch you in the mouth. If you are preaching today in a television visual age, in the media, they go to all kinds of extremes not to put something between the listener and, say, the newscaster. He or she may be reading it off of a prompter, but that prompter is such that the eye contact is established. Because they know the power of direct communication nonverbally. So that the answer to the first part of your question is nonverbal communication is extremely important in terms of communicating the message. Do you have a comment?
They also can do the other in terms of interviewing. They try to make it as possible to unsettle your what you're saying.
Yeah.
We had instruction. I was an economist in the Department of Agriculture, and we had instruction from a journalist about how to respond to interviews. And one of the things he said, for instance, was never to have a swivel chair. One of the common tricks is to give you a swivel chair because you start to get unsettled and nervous, and you look untrustworthy.
And you move.
And it throws the whole thing. So that communication is very, very.
And in our day, where you are involved sometimes with media, it's a great help to know just that, how you come over on camera, where you put your eyes. There's a temptation when you're speaking to an interviewer is to look at the interviewer, but you need to look at the camera. And because you're under pressure, your tendency is to look grim. If there's ever a time to force a smile, it's then. Because it says, I like it. In our country, I think one of the great skills of Jerry Falwell lies in his ability to handle interview programs. He doesn't do well in press conferences. He constantly blows it. He says the wrong thing. But when he gets on the talk shows, I've seen him on a talk show where the audience was against him when he started, and he can laugh at himself. Doesn't take himself that seriously, which is gives high marks in an American culture. He's willing to concede some points. He doesn't ask that he gets everything he wants. But before he's through, I've watched him after an hour, and the audience has been on his side. And there are very few people that can be defenders of a cause and do that. I mean, the flip side of that is Billy Graham is superb with news conferences, not nearly as good in interview shows. But Graham has gone through some awfully sticky wickets, but handles newspaper reporters very, very well. The second question about gestures. I think it can help if you're starting to get away from a pulpit, get away from something where you grab hold of it and you hang on there for dear life. Because if you're away from that, you will tend to let your body go. I often say to students at the seminary who are starting out, you ought to, in your introduction at least, plan a place to gesture. There's some place where you get your body moving. Because what will happen is your adrenaline starts flowing, and if you're not careful, you before long you're going to get this kind of warm feeling, or you put your hands in your pocket, or you stand there. That works against you. I don't think it's a wise idea to plan gestures in a sermon or anything like that. But some places to get your arms out there, to move them. It's amazing if you start that, the body will do what you normally do when you're talking. But the adrenaline and the fear and the whatever you want to call that, will work against you. And then it has a way of working against your whole delivery. Because the more you don't gesture, the more you get this build-up of fear. Whereas gestures enable you to take that and direct it. I think it's a help when you're first starting to practice in front of a mirror, to see yourself do it. I think you have to understand the different language systems you've got. One is the choice of words, another is intonation, and the third has to do with your gestures. So to see what you can do with your hands, how you can move them and so forth. You learn that or go through that, but then you forget it. You don't stand up there and say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. If you're starting out especially, maybe you ought to sew up your pants pockets. There's nothing wrong with putting your hands in your pocket if you know they're there. But they get warm after a while, and they're comfortable. And I've watched enough young preachers preach, and they gesture. because the body is saying, "Let's get with it. Let's gesture," and they can gesture out this way. What you want is to make them wide, make them definite. And if you can see yourself do it and feel that, then the gestures can work for you. I think most of all, if you can develop your content so that you're really into it, you're not just delivering a sermon, but you are really communicating. It's amazing how your nonverbal behavior begins to work for you. You can't work it very well from the outside. That is, if you try to plan your gestures, they don't work. because almost without exception, you'll be late. There are two things we need to know about God. And you watch, and something wrong. I mean, just the timing is off. You can work at timing before a mirror, but when you get up front, you've just got to let your gestures express what you're saying. And if you plan them, people sense that they're planned. Not a whole lot to tell you, but at least that's my best wisdom. Yes.
And there is an organization called Toastmasters, which is in the business of training people for public speaking, and gestures is a major part of that program. And I've personally benefited a great deal from being in that, and would recommend it to any preacher, particularly for gestures, eye contact, those mechanical aspects of speaking.
Sometimes when I'm working on the mechanical side of it, there is a place that a speaker comes to when he or she breaks what I call the sound barrier, and they are projecting, and they discover that people listen. I'll have students who, when they preach, they'll talk about the glories of God and how wonderful God is, and how we as Christians need really to be excited about Jesus Christ. You know? And we've got all the right words. Nothing's happening. You know? And I've gotten them, when that happens, I've said to the student, all right, you've got a D going for you. I'll raise it to a C if you can double your enthusiasm. Okay. We ought to be excited about Jesus Christ. So we got, that isn't making it either. Tell you what, I'll give you a B. I mean, I'll bribe you with anything like that. I'll give you a B. If you will double it. In fact, I'm going to stand at the back of this room and I want you to shout. I really want you to shout as though I were back there and I were 90 years old and I was deaf and you were going to tell me that the piano was going to drop on my head. I have never done that. And I use that. I have never done that with a student who's been able to pull that off. I mean, he will increase. And when I keep pushing, sometimes just to get me off his back, he's going to parody it. He's going to you know, caricature it. He's going to make me look bad, and so he's now going to speak loudly, and everybody in class is going to laugh, you know, at his speaking loudly. And you get about this, and it's not been unusual. The class is applauded. That's about right. And he's stunned. That is, where he is where he ought to be just when he's normal. But inside, in his head, he thinks he's screaming at the top of his voice, you know. But if you break that sound barrier and realize that you can have volume and you can be excited, and the audience hears it, you know, that's something else. But so a student has to get there, has to break the sound barrier. And they also have to understand how gestures work. They are an expression of thought, but in turn, they help you feel. So I had taken a piece of newspaper, rolled it up, and I said this, all right, look, we're not preaching, I just want to teach you something. Take this newspaper, and every time you make a point, as you're making a point, I want you to slam that newspaper on the desk. Bang it away, you know, head it at it. Well, when you start with the kind of person I'm talking about, I mean, they come up as though the thing was... if you try to hit a cricket shot that way, nothing would happen. So finally, again, often to get me off his back, he pounds on that desk. And all at once, his whole delivery changes. Toastmasters will do that kind of thing to help people understand what it feels like to have your whole body involved in a sermon. As long as I'm here, got another question?
I wonder how much of that, though, in our culture is related to the fact that we get very little congregational feedback. Now, I'm sure not every American church, you get response and body language back from the congregation, but I don't know how the other people feel, but basically you can preach in front of a congregation in Australia and they look dead. They really look dead. You've actually got to crack a joke to see if they're really awake. And somehow I feel that if you've got a congregation that's with you, it inspires you to be more energetic. I just comment on that one.
The myth is that great preachers make great churches. The truth is great churches make great preachers. There are churches that have a history of good preaching because they come, they're expectant, and they draw it out of you. And there are others that look like, you know, tombstones ready to die, and they sit there, it's terrible, it's very difficult. There are tough audiences. Whether or not that's true across the culture, only you would know. It is true that in certain audiences, like watching cricket matches, or day cricket matches, 5-day cricket matches, only the dead watch those. Australian rules football. People go fanatical. There are times in which the audience does respond. I doubt that they do it very much in church. You can thank God if you've got 3 or 4 people in the church who give you feedback. The kind of person who shakes their head. Some of you do that very well. Others, I think they brought in dead and they're still here. Yes.
Hayden, in your preaching, do you enjoy the formal education or the informal educational settings? Which one is best for you? Or in your educational, when you're preaching, do you enjoy a formal setting for preaching or an informal setting for preaching? What's been coming across to us is sometimes seems informal, but then again, it may be in a formal setting that you're just more relaxed.
I think I prefer today the more informal setting. I have to speak out of American culture. American culture is less and less formal, and therefore what comes through as formal and form in that sense often hinders interaction. That may not be true in England, may not be true in other cultures, but we live in a more and more formal culture, and therefore I find that the less formal the arrangement, the easier it is to interact with an audience. By the way, as long as we're talking about delivery, I might as well give you one more shot for I just want to plan to do. When you speak, there are only 4 ways you can get variety in your speaking. And what I'm going to talk about is sort of the punctuation of speech. And the thing that helps you in your speaking is variety. Any kind of sameness over a period of time works against you. So you want variety. You want variety in your content and so forth, but you want variety in your delivery. There are only 4 ways you can get variety. One is by the change of force. That is the loudness and the quietness. If you want to make a point, you can raise your voice and make the point. Or if you've been talking this way and you want to make the point, you can drop your voice. What makes the point is variety, loudness or softness. That's force. In American culture, in some churches, all the preacher knows to do is force. He has 2 levels, loud and very loud. So that shouting is a means of doing this, okay? And that's just part of their tradition. A second way you can get variety is by the changing of the rate, going faster and slower. There are sometimes in a sermon that you preach more rapidly. You're covering material and you go more rapidly. Other times, though, you slow down. Whether you go more rapidly or whether you slow down is not what matters. What matters is the change. It's the variety in rate. Most speaking runs about 135 words a minute, which is statistic. It doesn't mean much because you don't stand there and count them. But that is the basic rate of conversation. A sportscaster, when he is broadcasting an exciting match, can be up to about 180 words a minute. 190 words up there. I mean, that's how rapidly he can speak. But there may be times when you go rapidly, when you are trying to talk about the way we devote ourselves to Jesus Christ and the many different ways that people have tried to express their piety. That would be faster than 130 words a minute. Or you could say, we have expressed our piety in a number of different ways. Different people, different times, different places, different personnel. All you've done is change rate, okay? So the first has to do with force, louder and softer. Second has to do with rate, faster and slower. The third way you get variety is by pitch. This would be like the notes on the scale. Sometimes, as you're speaking, you may raise your voice. You stand before a sovereign God. Your voice goes up. That's the pitch. Or you could do the same thing and say, "We stand before a sovereign God." Pitch goes down. A variety in pitch. A monotone keeps on the same pitch all the way through. That's what we mean by monotone, one tone, one pitch. So, good speaking, like good conversation, goes up in pitch, it goes down in pitch. Most men have more range down than they have up, which is interesting. That is, they do not develop the lower ranges. Often, the lower range is more interesting to listen to. When women speak, one of the difficulties that women face is that their voices tend to be higher. When I work with women speakers, one of the things I work on is to bring that pitch down. One reason that women are often accused of nagging is not because they nag. It's because what they say in a higher voice. And a higher voice bothers you. A lower voice has about it overtones that are easier to listen to. It's true with men, it's true with women. But the point I make is that the variety is there. The fourth way you can get variety in your delivery is by the use of a pause. Over the years, as I've been in the area of communication, it's been interesting to have professors who have distinguished the professional from the amateur in speaking. One of my professors at Illinois used to say the thing that distinguishes the professor from the professional from the amateur is when he gets up, you're sure the professional isn't going to forget. You've all been to piano concerts with kids. You know, they start playing and they stop and they start over again. And then all you want, hope the kid will get through it and get out of there. Get a professional playing at a concert, you never worry about his forgetting. It's true with the speaker. But I had another professor who said that the difference between the professional and the amateur is that the professional knows how to use pauses. It's probably the hardest thing to learn in delivery. You have the feeling that if you don't keep talking, people are going to think you forgot. So you keep talking, gotta talk, gotta talk. Don't even stop to think, you're just going to talk. Because if you stop, what in the world is going to happen? But you can, if you stop and continue to look at an audience, you can stop for an enormously long period of time. 15 seconds. If you engage the audience in eye contact and you pause, that audience will pause with you. It's when you stop and you pause and you look away from the audience that you give it up. So, and what you're really doing if you pause is that you have to continue to think about what you're saying. In conversation, we do that. You and I are talking, and you say, let's see, it was when I was down in, it must have been Melbourne. Okay. You pause quite a bit of time there. But I understand that. You're thinking. And to watch someone think is an interesting experience. It happens so seldom, you put it down your book. So you have, and you put that down in four P's: pitch, punch, progress, and pause. You change your pitch, change your punch, your force, change your progress, your rate, the use of pause. Usually, those things go together. That is, often when you increase your force, you go up in pitch. In fact, I'd say that is almost the normal way to go. And I don't use normal in the saying, it's the right way to go. But as I increase volume, the tendency is for my pitch to go up and my throat to get sore. But if I know what I'm doing, I can increase the volume and go down in pitch. I can raise the volume at the same time that my pitch goes down. Saves my throat, and it gets the same thing done. It's a change, okay? You can use all of those along with a pause. One of the great speeches in American life was given by Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry, if he were a preacher, would have said, I know not what other course, I know not what course others will take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. But I think, as an orator, he probably would have said, I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. There's a whole lot of change there. They both do it. But the second uses a change in rate, change in force, change in pitch, the use of pause. That's all you can do to get variety in your delivery. There's no other things except those things in combination. They are like exclamation points, they are like periods, they are like underlining, whatever you want to do in written discourse. It is the punctuation of oral speech. So I'm going to talk about delivery. Those are the things you work with.
What about voice projection? Something that comes more naturally to some than others. And also breathing. Which influences all of
it. The breathing?
Yeah.
Voice projection is important. In our day, however, we have the advantage of a sound system. And I'd almost say an effective communicator today needs to know the advantage of a sound system. Delivery has gone more and more towards the appearance of conversation. And I use the word appearance. Good public speaking is conversation amplified and enlarged. A sound system enables you to do that. If you don't have a sound system and you were trying to talk to a room like this, then you'd have to almost shout to be heard, and you lose the advantage of rate and pitch and change. So today, given the move towards conversational speech, a sound system, a good sound system, is something that is a great ally. If you find that your throat hurts after you preach, then one possibility is that you're not breathing correctly. The tendency as you're standing is to breathe from your chest, and you don't get much air from your chest. So what you want to do is to breathe from your diaphragm. The diaphragm actually cuts your body this way. You can't feel it. It's this way across the bottom of your body. But you know you're using your diaphragm if your stomach goes out when you breathe. If you lie down and breathe and put your hand on your stomach, you breathe from your diaphragm. It's when you stand up that you stop breathing from your diaphragm. Good singers, good speakers will pack their tones against their stomach, and that gives a flow of breath across the vocal mechanism that relaxes the mechanism. If your throat doesn't bother you, don't worry much about it. But if it does bother you, that's one of the things you have to work on, breathing, because part of what's happening is you're not getting enough breath support. The other thing that causes bad throats is that you speak above your optimum pitch. Your optimum pitch is where you speak, where your voice is most relaxed. If you want to find it, let me give you a quick way of doing it. If you take a poem like Mary Had a Little Lamb, the fleece was white as snow, everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. And you whisper that. Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow. And then break out into sound. Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. You notice my voice came down. Because I have, by pushing this morning, my voice has gone up. Where I broke out, that is probably my optimum pitch. That means my voice is most relaxed. If your voice is above that, seldom will it be below it, but if your voice is above that, then what you need to do is find that on that note on the piano. Somebody who's got an ear can do that for you. And then using the alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, go down the musical keyboard. Practice going down. The optimum pitch is where your voice ought to be when you're just talking normally to a congregation. That's more important even than the breathing. Men tend to keep their pitch high, and probably the reason for it is our voices were high, and then our mechanism changed, but we tend to speak as we hear. You all speak Australian because you've heard it all your lives. I have a New York accent because I grew up with it, okay? We speak as we hear. So therefore, when the mechanism went down, the theory is we didn't let our voices go down. So something like 60 to 70% of men speak above their optimum pitch. No problem if you're ordering Coke or a hamburger. But you get up to speak and you have to use your voice a lot. You can ruin your vocal mechanism, put nodules on your vocal. So if you have problems with a sore throat, breathing is one, using the optimum pitch is another.